This lecture regarding the King Tzidkiyahu is dedicated by the Herman family to the memory of their father, Mr. Walter Price, Reb Shlomo ben Yisrael. The last king of Yehuda is the great King Tzidkiyahu. In a different age, they would have written a book about Tzidkiyahu called Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. Because Tzidkiyahu is, even though he's portrayed in the Tanakh as Vayasa Ra B'Enei Hashem, that he did things that were wrong, that were evil, the truth of the matter is that in the picture that we have of him from the Talmud, from Chazal, we have the picture of a very righteous, a very moral, a very idealistic, a very good person. But it is in his reign that everything goes wrong, that the Churban occurs, the destruction of the first temple, and he himself personally suffers terrible, terrible indignities. Terrible tragedy. I've often wondered, and I've looked in the commentaries, and have never found a satisfactory answer, but to find a satisfactory answer, one has to, so to speak, kaviyochel, read God's mind, which is impossible for human beings, for us to understand how things happen or why things happen. We can only observe them as they happen. But if King Menashe, for instance, the Beis HaMikdash would have been destroyed during his reign, or other of the evil kings of Judah, then we could justify it. When Menashe put a Salem, he put a pestle, an idol in the temple itself. He killed his grandfather, the Novi Yeshayahu. He undid the entire Jewish school system. He was a Rosh. And even though at the end of his life he did tshuva, but the picture that we have of him from Tanakh is that essentially of a monster. So we can understand that God in his wrath would come and destroy the Beis HaMikdash. You allowed this man to be the king. You let him run wild. Nobody ever said anything against him. That's it. It's all over. And there's an Erech HaPayim, there's a patience, so to speak, that God shows towards the evil kings. And I have an intuition. I don't know whether it's correct or not. All my wife's intuitions are correct, but mine are sometimes faulty. And she had the intuition to marry me, right? So I have an intuition that a good leader is always held to a higher standard. Not only to a higher standard, we see it in Chazal, that if the person was good, then Kaviyochel, the Rabbonu Shalom, demands more from him. And it should have been better. And that therefore the punishment that came upon Tzidkiyahu and the punishment that came upon the people of Judah and the destruction of the temple and the ending of the monarchy of the house of David, all of those terrible events are not necessarily for sins of commission as much as they are for sins of omission. For instance, Chazal say, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it says on the Pusik that I mentioned, Vayasa Rab Enei Hashem, that Tzidkiyahu did what was wrong in the eyes of God. So if you read the Tanakh cold, you would think that he was an idolater, that he did other of the sins that unfortunately were common to the Jewish people at that time. But Chazal say, Shehoyo Biyodo Limchos Velo Micho. He had within himself the ability to protest. He had the ability to improve. He had the ability to stop evil. Below Micho, and he didn't do it. whether he didn't do it because he felt his protest would be useless, whether he didn't do it because he didn't feel the moment was propitious. There are a thousand reasons that every human being has for not doing something. And most of the time in life, we rarely regret what we have not done. We usually only regret things that we have done. But here Chazal say, Shehoyo biyodo limchos velo micho. He had the opportunity to improve the situation. Velo micho, and he did not do so. He let it drift. Chazal tell us terrible things about his time. Chazal tell us, for instance, that there were Kohanim who served in the Beis HaMikdash who no longer were circumcised, who abandoned the Bris Milah. There are, irreligious rabbis, which is not a rare phenomenon among the Jewish people. The Kohanim did not believe in Mila anymore. And nevertheless, that's a Medrash in Eicha. Nevertheless, he let it happen. He didn't protest. There's an inkling in the Medrash that if the Jews were to close down the Beis HaMikdash themselves, so then the Churban wouldn't have come. But the temple worship, the service in the Beis HaMikdash had become such a part of their lives that they could not imagine doing such a thing. So therefore we are talking here about sins of omission, and we're not talking about sins of commission. And in looking at it in that fashion, we have an inkling of why Chazal dealt with Tzidkiyahu as a person in such a positive fashion, and yet the events of his time and of his life were so uniformly bleak and negative, they were so catastrophic for himself and for all of the Jewish people. Now, what happened was that Yechonia, who was the king of Yechoniah, who was the king of Yehuda, was taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar came and he laid siege to the city and he captured Yechoniah. This is in the year 597 before the Common Era, 11 years before the destruction of the temple. And he took them all away. He took the Sanhedrin away. He took Yecheskel Anovi. He took them all away. And he left as the king of Yehuda, Tzidkiyahu, who was the uncle of Yechoniah. Tzidkiyahu was the son of King Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu was a righteous king. Tzidkiyahu was a righteous king. But he made an agreement with Tzidkiyahu. And the agreement was that under no circumstances would Tzidkiyahu rebel against him. In other words, that the kingdom of Judah was ended as an independent, autonomous country. The Jews could stay there. The Jews could manage their affairs. The Jews could keep the Beis HaMikdash open. All of that he allowed. But they had to pay him taxes. They had to swear allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar, to the king of Bavel, and their foreign policy, so to speak, and defense policy, whatever words you want to use, they were in the orbit. They were a satellite of Bavel. It's probably a cross between being Poland next to Russia today, or being even one of the so-called independent republics of the Soviet Union. It doesn't allow for any political freedom. It doesn't allow for really much room to stray. But it did allow for the retention of the Beis HaMikdash and the fact that the Jews continued to live in Yerushalayim,
and to live throughout Yehuda. That's what was offered. And Tzidkiyahu accepted, and he not only accepted, but he took a vow. He took a shvua.
Now, Nebuchadnezzar was well acquainted with Jewish customs. And he knew that a vow, a shvua that's taken with God's name, so then Jews are loath to breach that. We know that as a matter of course today. Jews are reluctant to take an oath, even on things that are absolutely 100% true. Here in our country, under the Constitution, we are allowed to affirm instead of to take an oath. But taking an oath was never a minor matter. Even amongst Jews who were not particularly observant of anything else. I had an interesting matter regarding someone who lives in a country in Europe that will go unnamed. And he had a relationship to the yeshiva. And he was accused by the Internal Revenue Service of that country of sequestering a great deal of money and of not reporting it. And the government could not prove the case. But the judge, who in my, I don't know the law of that country, but the judge, who in my opinion certainly overstepped judicial boundaries, said that since the man is a Jew and an observant Jew, if he'll take an oath that he didn't do it, then all the charges will be dismissed. So then the question arose, should he do it or not? So why he came to me, I don't know, because he had much greater rabbis in the country where he lives. But it's a difficult question. I could never find out whether he did do it or didn't do it. And B, even if he didn't do it, then there's a question of whether to take an oath, because even for something that's correct. But the viewpoint of the judge to me was interesting. That he was willing to accept it. He was willing to accept that if an Orthodox Jew would take an oath, even though we're talking about a large sum of money, then that to him was sufficient proof that the man was not involved in the fraud. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had the same viewpoint. Nebuchadnezzar said, you know, if I get his signature on the paper, if we have a handshake, if we make an agreement, you know, it's at best a cold peace, right? It's the Israel-Egypt peace agreement. It's hard to enforce. But if he takes an oath, so then I have no problem. Then I know that he will live up to it. Because there's no Jewish king who will willingly violate and forsake an oath that he takes. According to the Medrash, the oath was taken. He took him into the courtyard of the Beis Hamikdash, thereby violating the fact that a Gentile entered the precincts, but the Jews had no choice, and he made him swear by the corner of the altar, by the horn, by the Karen HaMizbeach. And there's another sheet that holds that he made him swear by the horn of the altar, not of the outside altar, which was in the courtyard, but of the inside golden altar, which was already in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So in Halacha, that would be called a shvua benikitas chefetz, a shvua holding an item of holiness. We find that originates with our father Abraham, that he said to Eliezer, Simno yodcho tachas yerechi, in which he, the only mitzvah that he had, which then was the mitzvah of milah, so then that was the symbol of the holiness of the oath. In halacha, we have nikitas chefetz, that if a person takes an oath in front of a bezdin, he holds the Sefer Torah. Said that that's the that to impress the person with the seriousness of the matter and with the liabilities that are involved. So here Nebuchadnezzar took Tzidkiyahu into the Beis HaMikdash and he had him hold the corner of the altar, whether it be the outside bronze altar which was in the courtyard or the inside golden oil altar which was in the building, and he took the oath. The next day Nebuchadnezzar packed up and he went home because he felt certain that that his trust would never be violated. He never had to worry about it. Now there's a second medrash. The one what I just told you, Chazal tell us in the medrash of Eicha, but there's a second medrash which appears in the Psikta, is that he made him take an oath with the Sefer Torah, and that Tzidkio offered to swear on his life, and he said, no, your life is meaningless. You have to swear to me on the Sefer Torah, and he swore to him on the Sefer Torah itself. In any event, you now have that Tzidkiyahu had taken upon himself this oath not to revolt against Nebuchadnezzar. What happened was that Tzidkiyahu immediately did revolt. Different opinions how and why it happened. One reason, which again the Medrash mentions, an interesting Medrash, is that Tzidkiyahu lost all respect for Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar invited him to eat with him, and he gave him inferior food. Nebuchadnezzar apparently had the table manners of Henry VIII. And he ate, the Lashon of the Medrash is Bosar Shehivhev. We would say today he ate barbecue, he ate grilled steak, right? Which was not the kings of Yehuda, the kings of Yisrael were much more delicate. They were used to a finer fare. And he drooled and he got drunk. And what happened was that Tzidkiyahu in his heart said that how can it be that the whole world should be subservient to this boor? How could it be that this man should rule and to think that he can rule over me and rule over Yerushalayim and over the Beis HaMikdash? And at that moment, he took it upon himself to break his vow. The Gemara explains to us that he legally was able to do so because he went in front of the Sanhedrin and they found him a loophole. And on the basis of the loophole in the laws of vows, he said that it was permissible. Later on, the Nebuchadnezzar would take revenge against the Sanhedrin also because he was aware that they were the ones that, so to speak, legalistically gave an opening to the treachery of Tzidkiyahu. Now, in all of this, the Novi Yirmiyahu was against it. The Novi Yirmiyahu was against any of these machinations. But the Novi Yirmiyahu was practically powerless. When Tzidkiyahu came to power, the Novi was still in jail. He was in the dungeon.
Chazal say that the real name of Tzidkiyahu was not Tzidkiyahu. As I've mentioned to you many times regarding the other kings, there was a given name, like the name that they received at their bris, their Jewish name, and then there was an official name, which was the name that they were given when they became the king. That custom still prevails in the world today. That the when they, for instance, in England, when the monarch is crowned, then he or she chooses what name they want to be known by. Lahavdil, Elef Havdolis, in the Pope of Rome, does the same thing. That it's like it's a new person. So they chose the name. So his real name was Matanyo ben Yoshiyahu. Matanyo, meaning the gift of God. That was his real name. All of Chazal agree that that was his real name. The Gemara in Shkolim says it. But why was he called Tzidkiyahu? So the Gemara says a number of reasons why he was called Tzidkiyahu. One reason is because he made himself into a tzaddik. Even though the events that happened in his life were so negative, he justified them. He accepted them. He never spoke against God. A second reason that's mentioned is that he took the prophet Yirmiyahu out of prison. He took him out of the dungeon. He released him from prison, even though he knew that the Novi Yirmiyahu would not be a good boy. He would not be quiet. And that the reasons that he was placed in prison, those reasons were now still valid. And the Novi would continue to be, so to speak, a thorn in the side of the government, because the Novi would speak against the government policy. Nevertheless, he had him removed from the dungeon. He had him freed, and Yirmiyahu continued, and in those 11 years, Yirmiyahu preached against everything that Tzidkiyahu's policy was. And the Novi's policy was that the Jewish people should take a very low posture, and that if they can wait it out with Nebuchadnezzar, good. But his ultimate prophecy is that nothing would help. And that the Rabboni Shalom had decreed that the temple would be destroyed, and Israel would be taken into exile, and that there was no way to escape that fate. However, since the Novi knew, and everyone else knew as well, that prophecies of evil, negative prophecies, do not necessarily have to come about, even when stated by a Novi, but that prophecies of evil can be retracted, they can be taken back. So therefore, there was always a hope, and the Novi himself had the hope that somehow the Jewish people would come to their senses and the Churban could be averted. But Tzidkiyahu was not buying any of it. Tzidkiyahu felt, and his advisors convinced him. Now, it's always one of the great mysteries of life, the advisors to kings, to presidents, to leaders. They always try to pick the smartest person, the best person, and invariably they always lead them astray. They always give them very bad advice. And then they fight for the bad advice, to the extent that the king is unable to reverse it on his own. Here they convinced him somehow that they had enough power to withstand Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the Assyrian empire, Ashur. He was the largest empire in the world. He had just been in Yerushalayim, besieged it and captured it and taken Yechoniah away. And yet they were able to convince Tzidkiyahu that it wouldn't happen to him, that he would be able to mount a successful defense of Yerushalayim. And there were three arguments that they used. Now the three arguments, like many times in a debate, are self-contradictory. But that logic plays no role when people make up their mind. So then you can take three-year logical arguments and put them together and say, I did it on the basis of reason. The first piece of logic was, he's not coming back. It's too long a trip. An old man, he's not coming back. Why should he bother with us? We're a speck on the map, right? We're a fly. We don't count. And therefore, we don't have to worry. He will ignore us. That was the first argument. The second argument is that we're so strong that we're going to beat him. If he dares come, our army and our defenses, we will be able to withstand any siege that he will place upon us. We need not fear that he will be successful. What happened last time was a fluke. We weren't ready, right? The quarterback was injured. We weren't in good shape. We didn't know. This time we're ready. The third argument was, and this was the most subtle and the argument that was most wrong, was that Egypt will protect us. They had a treaty with Egypt, which is really the breach that Nebuchadnezzar considered to be treachery and rebellion. Because the counterweight to the Babylonian Empire in the north was always the Egyptian Empire in the south. And poor little Israel, like today, is stuck in the middle. I saw there's a book by Zev Chaifetz, who was the press secretary for Begin during the 7 years that Begin was the prime minister. Chaifetz is an American-born Detroit guy who has a very good sense of humor, just enough cynicism to be able to be a government official. So he's written a book that I recommend you reading because it has very, very good insights into the society of Israel. It's called Heroes, Hustlers, Hard Hats, and Holy Men in the Holy Land. And the one statement that he makes there about it, he said, Israel is a good country in a bad neighborhood. And that sums it up pretty well. We're in a very bad neighborhood. Well, we've always been in that neighborhood, and it's never been a good neighborhood. And because of that, they always found themselves, the Jewish people always found themselves between conflicting empires. And being at the crossroads of the Middle East, those empires were vitally interested in Israel. So the Jews figured, their third argument was, well, Egypt cannot afford to let us go under. Because if Nebuchadnezzar of Babel comes and conquers us, so then he's on the doorstep of Egypt, and that they can't allow to happen. And therefore, even if they're not on our side, they will come to protect us. You hear echoes of that argument today regarding Israeli-American relationships, regarding other types of ideas. It's pie in the sky. It's whistling Dixie. It's worse than that. It's whistling past the graveyard. And the Novi Yirmio said all the time, Egypt is not going to lift a finger for you. There is no army that will come and defend you. Egypt itself is only a paper tiger. Nebuchadnezzar will destroy Egypt, which he did. But nevertheless, these arguments were enough to convince Sidkiyahu somehow that he could withstand Nebuchadnezzar and withstand his onslaught. Now, there's one other factor that has to be brought into play here, and this is the first time that this occurs in Jewish history, even though it will occur many, many times thereafter. Nebuchadnezzar now, in effect, had a large number of Jews as hostage.
for the loyalty of Sitkiyahu and the Jews in Yehuda. And these people were hostage. That was the king Yechoniah and the Sanhedrin and their families. The more than 10,000 Jews that were taken in the first exile in 597. Nebuchadnezzar thought that that also would be sufficient to guarantee that the Jews in Jerusalem would not revolt against him, because he knew that Jews are to a great extent loyal one to another. It's only when they're left to their own devices among themselves that they behave the way they do. But and if Jews are in danger, other Jews will rally to them. We've seen that in our time regarding Jews in Russia, Jews in Syria, Jews in Iran. There's a feeling that you have to do something. And there's also a feeling that that affects your foreign policy. The Israeli foreign policy towards South Africa has within it elements that are clearly influenced by the fact that there are 120,000 Jews in South Africa who have a precarious existence. The government could say that they're also not white. South Africa is a very strange country. The Japanese are white, because they need the Japanese. But the Malaysians are not white. They're colored already. So the government could say that the Jews are also colored. When I was in South Africa, the whole problem, there was a Sephardic Jew that was there who was very, very dark. And when he went to register, you have to register, and on your papers they say what you are. So she said, you know, the lady in the office said, you can't be white. And he said he was white. And it was a whole thing, you know, and the rabbinate had to write letters and everything till they made him white. I think that's the prophecy of the Novi, right? That if your sins are red, they'll turn white, right? Red can turn white, black can turn white too, but white can turn black. They make up their minds what you are. So there is a slight amount of influence because there's 120,000 Jews held hostage. The relationship to the Soviet Union, there are millions of Jews held hostage. Even the relationship to Iran, you know, the open enmity. So Israel had many reasons, in spite of the open enmity, to supply Iran with spare parts and war material, etc., to keep them going in the war. So part of it was because they were against Iraq, etc., but part of it is there's 25,000 Jews. And those 25,000 Jews are in his hands. The Ayatollah can do with them what he wants. So here you have, for the first time in Jewish history, that somebody played that card. It would be played over and over and over again the rest of Jewish history. But Nebuchadnezzar thought that because of the fact that he had Jews in Bovel who were under his control, and that they were his prisoners, that he could expect therefore a bit of loyalty, simply because they would not want to endanger those Jews. It's very interesting that he did nothing to the Jews in Bovel, even when the rebellion against him occurred, and that the Jews in Bovel did live a fairly decent life under the rule of that tyrant. And they were allowed to develop their community, to develop the synagogues and yeshivas, which later were the basis of Babylonian Jewry. In any event, so Tzidkiyahu had that righteousness with him. And he, however, followed this wrong policy. He followed the wrong policy completely. And because of that, therefore, eventually Nebuchadnezzar could no longer take it. And in the year
586 before the Common Era, in the spring of that year, Nebuchadnezzar came with his army, and he began the siege of Jerusalem. On the 10th day of Tammuz, the walls were breached, and on the 9th day of Av, a month later, the city fell. The Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, burned to the ground, and the king of Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, had a general by the name of Nebuzaradan. Nebuzaradan is called in Tanakh Rav HaTabochim, the chief murderer of his time, one of the most bloodthirsty people that we meet in Tanakh. And he massacred the Jewish population of Jerusalem. And we read of that in the Megillas Eicha, the description of the siege, of the famine, of the pestilence, of the sword, of the massacre, of the fire that raged. All of that is recorded by the Novi Yirmio. He says, Ani Agever, I'm the man that saw it. It's the eyewitness account of the terrible destruction and desolation that occurred. It's interesting, Chazal tell us that Nebuzaradan was Chozer B'tshuva at the end. One of the famous stories regarding the Churban that appears in the Gemara is that there was a spot of blood on the floor of the Beis Hamikdash. And that spot of blood was from the Novi Scharia, who was killed in the Beis Hamikdash by the king's men for having prophesied against the policy of the government. And no matter what the Jewish people did, they could not erase that blood from the floor of the temple. Even though the floor was marble, and they had the greatest cleaning supplies, etc., they could not remove that spot of blood. The Ribbono Shel Olam didn't allow it. And Nebuzaradan knew about it, and he tried to wash the blood away with blood. So the Talmud tells us he killed infants, he killed women, he killed the Sanhedrin. They brought the Sanhedrin that had given Sitkio the permission to renounce the vow. They killed them. They killed the elders of Israel. Killed everybody. And the blood kept on boiling. The spot didn't move. So he was himself so overcome by the slaughter and by what was occurring. So he shouted, he said, you want me to kill everybody? I'll kill all the Jewish people. And when he said that, then it stopped. The spot disappeared. It stopped boiling. The spot disappeared. That made such an impression upon him that he said to himself, look at the blood of one innocent man. God refused to erase that blood, and thousands of people died because of it, all because of the blood of one innocent man. He said, I who have killed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of innocent people, their vengeance will be upon me forever. What can I do? And at that moment he did tshuva, the Medrash says, the Gemara says. He regretted it. And he died on the spot. And a voice came forth from heaven and said, Nebuzaradan is l'olam habo. Nebuzaradan's tshuva is accepted. So the comment to that, there are many comments to that story, but the comment to that is that in that level of doing tshuva, the only tshuva that helps is to die. There is a level where if the person realizes what he did, and it's of such enormity that realization kills him. His system cannot withstand it. The trauma, the shock of the discovery of the enormity of his crime, that kills him. Gemara tells the same story a number of times, aside from Nebuzaradan, about others who were great Rishoyim, terrible Rishoyim, and then in a moment of truth, they saw what they did, and they were so overcome by that realization that they died. But dying is the requirement. Sometimes people come to me, they say, you know, they're dying to do tshuva. So I say that, you know, don't take that literally, because the Gemara does. There's a level of tshuva that requires that. Short of that, it's not tshuva. But in any event, the destruction was complete. The temple is destroyed. The Kohanim, the Sanhedrin, the officers, everybody is destroyed. The Jewish world is at an end. The king attempts to escape. The king had built an escape tunnel, which runs from what is today the banana market in East Jerusalem. There's a large cave, which by tradition they say it's the Chatzer HaMatara, which is the dungeon where Yirmiyahu was. In that cave, the cave forks into two directions. The Arabs, with their great sense of historical honor, have a banana market in the cave. But legend has it that if you take the right fork, you enter into a tunnel. That tunnel runs from Jerusalem till just outside Jericho, about 18 miles. And the Tanakh tells us that Tzidkiyahu had such a tunnel prepared. In the event, he was sure he was going to win, and he was sure Nebuchadnezzar wasn't going to come, and he was sure that Egypt was going to save him, but just in case... Just in case all the things we're sure of aren't so sure, so he had this escape route. And he and his sons and his personal bodyguard and some of his army officers escaped through the tunnel. The Babylonians had discovered the tunnel by the use of wild animals had run in the tunnel, and they had seen deer come out of the tunnel. So they knew there was a tunnel. And therefore, they allowed him to escape, and they waited for him at the mouth of the tunnel, where they were all captured. I have had Israeli guides who have told me that they, in their youth, marched through the tunnel, but I doubt it. But maybe that's cynical of me, but I don't know. But that the tunnel existed is for certain. That it may exist today, and also it's a possibility. It certainly can happen. When he was arrested... So he was brought before Nebuchadnezzar. Now, under all circumstances, Nebuchadnezzar was less than a magnanimous winner. And in fact, the custom in the ancient world was no quarter given and no quarter asked. And that the kings of, and generals of opposing armies, if you lost, you lost. It's a little like working for Steinbrenner. That's it. You're going to get beheaded. But here, Nebuchadnezzar was even more malicious, more malevolent, because of the fact that he felt personally betrayed. As I mentioned to you, Tzidkiyahu had taken this oath, and he felt personally betrayed. And therefore... He punished Tzidkiyahu in a most horrendous fashion. So Tzidkiyahu said to him, again, this is the Lashon of the Psikta, and the Medrash also appears in Eicha. The Medrash in Eicha asked the question, why didn't he commit suicide? He knew when he was caught, he should have, the lashon of the Medrash is that he should have banged his head against the wall. Lo hoya bodas latiach es rosho bakosa lachetetze nishmoso. He didn't have enough presence of mind to realize what was going to happen here. And that the easiest thing for him, the most heroic thing for him, the most halachically acceptable thing for him, because the halacha is that even though one is not allowed to commit suicide, but for instance in the Middle Ages and the Crusades and in other events that happened in Jewish history, suicide was acceptable, just as it was acceptable in the Holocaust in many instances, as a preferable means instead of a death that would shame and perhaps bring others into inform upon others, etc. And it would be the symbol. I mean, that's Shaul HaMelech said to the spear bearer, let on that to kill him, and then he fell on his own sword rather than allow the Philistines to capture him alive, because he knew what type of shame that would bring to the Jewish people, how it would crush the morale of Israel. So the Medrash in Eicha says that Sitkio should have committed suicide. But the Medrash says that that was part of the curse that the Novi Yirmio said, that the king won't have heart, the king won't be able to do it. He wouldn't be able to bring himself to it. So when he was brought before Nebuchadnezzar, Sitkio said, kill me first, because I don't want to see you kill my sons. And his sons, who were the princes of Judah, said that they wanted to be killed first so they should not have to see the death of their father. And what Nebuchadnezzar did was that he killed the sons in front of Sitkiyahu, and then he blinded him. He put out his eyes, so that the last thing that he ever saw in his life was that terrible, horrendous scene of his sons being killed by the executioners of the Babylonian army by Nebuchadnezzar. And that was a confirmation again of the prophecy of the Novi Yirmio. The Novi said, "Lebovel atoholech, you're going to go to Bovel. Ubebovel tomus, and don't ever think you're coming back to Eretz Yisrael. You're going to die in Bovel. Ubovel einecho lo yiru, but you will never see Bovel." So when the Novi said that to him, so that was cryptic. And he dismissed it. And he dismissed it because it was against his policy and against his self-interest. And he was convinced that Yirmio was wrong and he was right. And what does it mean? If he's going to Bovel, he's going to die in Bovel, what does it mean he's never going to see Bovel? But now when he came to Bovel blind, so the lashon of the Medrash was, Hareini bebovel ve'einai lo ro'o so-so. Here I am in Bovel, and the Novi is correct, and I have never seen Bovel, and I will never see Bovel. Sitkio was offered, was held by the Jewish population in Bovel as a symbol of righteousness and of rectitude. Now Nebuchadnezzar had him imprisoned for many years, but amongst the Jewish people, his memory didn't depart, and the Jewish people helped him. They helped him in prison, because it's an interesting thing. Again, the complexity of the person. One would think that the Jewish people would resent him, because he and his policies evidently were the means by which they were doomed. The destruction of Israel took place, the destruction of Judah and of Yerushalayim and of the Beis HaMikdash. So we would be, even in the United States, even a failed president after a period of time, no matter how bad, if you live long enough, you get resurrected. in public esteem, right? It happened to Hoover, it's happening to Nixon, it's happening to Carter. But the Jews held that Tzidkiyahu was a righteous, pious, good person from the onset. And they did not blame him for what happened. But they took it, in the as the Novi said, that it had to happen. It was Ho'ovos ochlu boser, the fathers ate sour grapes, and the children's teeth are on edge. In other words, it's part of their genetic inheritance. They were doomed. The sins of Judah were of such nature that there was no hope. And therefore, Tzidkiyahu was not to blame. He's not to be seen as the cause of the Churban, but rather be seen as a participant, as an actor in the play, but he's not the playwright. He didn't write it. It was not his actions that caused it. So in Bovel, he came to the status of a righteous person. And from the Medrash, it seems that part of the reason that he was Tzidkiyahu is because they held him to be a tzaddik. And he also was the last connection to the royalty, to the house of David, to previous greatness. And therefore the Jews treated him with a great deal of respect. Medrash tells us an interesting thing in Eicha Rabbah. The Medrash tells us that the Jews in Bovel, talk about dual loyalty, right? The Jews in Bovel were forced to celebrate the victory of Nebuchadnezzar over Tzidkiyahu, and that they came to welcome their brethren, so they wore white clothing on the outside, meaning the Yontif clothing. But on the inside, they wore black clothing, mourning, sackcloth. So that's not just only the description of their costume, that's the description of how the Jews felt. On the outside, they had to be good Babylonians. Right? You have to follow American foreign policy. We have to do what's good for the national interest. All the people that write for the op-ed page of the Times. No such thing as Jewish interests. And if Jewish interests conflict with general interests, so certainly the Jewish interests have to give way. So the Jews in Bovel were also in the same predicament. And the Medrash says, on the outside they have to rejoice, on the outside they have to wear white clothing, on the outside they have to wave the Babylonian flag. But on the inside, they wore mourning. They wore black clothes. They wore sackcloth. On the inside, their hearts were breaking because of the destruction and because of the defeat and everything that happened. And it is really, as I'll discuss in the next lecture, it really was the greatness of God that allowed the Jews in Bovel to find a prosperous, vibrant Jewish community when they came there. Because that's what made Golas Bovel special, unique. When the masses of Jews came, they came already to an infrastructure that existed. They came to, everything was built for them. Whereas in most other exiles where we have come, and especially the exile of the United States, we're always playing catch-up. The Jews were here first, right? The synagogues and the yeshivas and everything else didn't happen till later. And therefore, it is of no wonder that so many Jews assimilated, drifted off, the entire Jewish agenda, so to speak, got off the track. Our rabbis tell us that Tzidkiyahu had the triumph of outliving Nebuchadnezzar. The Medrash says that on the 25th day of the month of Adar, Nebuchadnezzar died. On the 26th day, his successor, Evil-Merodach, took office. And even though Evil-Merodach was descended from him, with either his son or his nephew or his grandson, but he took the body of Nebuchadnezzar out of the grave and dragged it through the streets to show that he was the new emperor and he was not dependent upon Nebuchadnezzar. And as a further sign of his newfound power, he canceled all of Nebuchadnezzar's degrees. So on the 27th of Adar, Yechoniah was taken out of prison. That was the first king who'd been there 11 years. And Tzidkiyahu was also taken out of prison. But according to the Medrash, Tzidkiyahu died within the month. Within the month after his release from prison, within the month after Evil-Merodach had redeemed him from jail and had allowed him to come out, apparently the burden of everything that happened to him was of such a nature that he passed away. He died. And there was, almost till our time, there were markers in Babylonia, near the city of Baghdad, that claimed to be markers of the tombs of the Judean kings who died there. In other words, Yechoniah and Tzidkiyahu. And there was a custom in the Babylonian Jewish community even to visit those graves as being holy places. All traces of the graves no longer exist. They didn't exist already from the beginning of this century. Whether it was the Jews that forgot or the Ottoman Turks that did it that way, we don't know. But today, there is no, even the tradition is not there anymore. And especially because there are no more Babylonian Jews left to live in Iraq, in Bovel. So the entire thing is questionable. We don't know anything about it. But what we do know is that both Yechoniah and Tzidkiyahu died in Bovel, were buried in Bovel. They never returned to the land of Israel, to the land of Judah that they had ruled. And Tzidkiyahu is the last of the kings, the final king that we have until now in the dynasty of the house of David, until the time of the Mashiach, because none of the kings in the second Beis HaMikdash were from the house of David, and none of the rulers, with the exception of Zerubbabel, claimed royal ancestry, and the dynasty of Malchus Beis David went into hiatus and went into abeyance for the entire period of time, until the time when the Melech HaMashiach will come. Then he will be descended from the house of David and sit on the throne of Tzidkiyahu.